Case number 06-5155, Dorothy Greer, appellant versus Henry M. Paulson, Jr., Secretary, United States Department of Treasury. Mr. Wagner for the appellant, Ms. Barnett for the appellee.
May it please the court. The district court's order granting summary judgment should be reversed for four reasons. The first reason concerns the hostile work environment claim, and the second through fourth concern the racial discrimination claim. First, the district court erred by holding that Ms. Greer's hostile work environment claim was time barred. It was not. Ms. Greer complained of discriminatory acts within 45 days of seeking EEO counseling.
And which of those acts were related to the hostile race claim?
The acts related to the hostile race claim were...
Because you have to show two things, right? You've got to show, A, that they were related to the hostile race claim. The other thing, after Ledbetter, you have to show that they weren't, you know, discrete, actionable acts that were brought in a claim elsewhere, right? You have to survive the Ledbetter analysis of whether it's a discrete act. But let's go to the first
one. Right.
Which of these is related to a hostile racially discriminatory environment?
First act was on May 1st, 1995, within 9 days of seeking the counseling, when Ms. Greer found herself unable to return to the hostile environment and the racial taunts and harassment that she had experienced, and she requested leave. That leave was denied. She was threatened to be categorized as AWOL if she refused to return to that environment, and the IRS refused to remedy the environment.
I'm not understanding. Maybe I misunderstood the question or the answer, one or the other, but what's the acts of hostile environment that occurred in either of what you just described?
The hostile environment that occurred before...
No. At the time of the events that you just described, what act creating a hostile environment occurred then? I mean, she'd been gone to the White House for, a year and a half or so.
She didn't go to work for roughly a year and a half at
the IRS. She came back, but she didn't come back.
No.
And so what hostile act occurred after the White House detail?
They insisted that she return to the same environment.
They insisted that she return to an office with two people she didn't want to be with, maybe for good reasons. But can you imagine us writing a precedent that says it's a hostile work environment to be in an office with two other people?
I could imagine a precedent.
And they haven't done anything at that point. It's been a year and a half since anything's happened.
Some of the comments that made up the pre-detail.
A year and a half earlier.
Correct. Were made by the people.
A year and a half earlier.
Correct.
But what has happened in the time frame of the current regime that creates a hostile work environment?
The failure to remedy the hostile work environment and the insistence...
How do we know there'd been a failure to remedy? She didn't go back. If she had gone back and somebody had made remarks, and I mean, assuming that there was a hostile work environment, not just isolated incidents, but assume that for the moment, we don't know whether they've remedied it or not. She didn't go back. There was a different supervisor, a different era. How do we know there was any environment at all by that time?
The ultimate supervisor was the same, was Mr.
The immediate supervisor.
The immediate supervisor had changed. That's correct.
Let me ask you, were there any racist comments made in that 45-day period to her?
Racist comments?
Yes or no. In the 45-day period, were there any racist comments made to her?
The answer is no. In that they were not overt.
So your argument is, if we don't accept your failure to remedy rationale, which would be, that's a new argument for us, right? We have not. Some of our sister circuits have adopted this, but you're asking us to do something that we haven't done before. So putting that to one side, putting aside the failure to remedy argument, what are the acts that happened within 45 days of her meeting with the EEO counselor that were part of the hostile environment?
The other acts, in addition to what we had discussed, were the two comments made by Mr. Carter to the union representative. Those were made on May 10th, the day of the EEO counseling, and they're memorialized in the union representative's affidavit, Mr. Pollard, which is in the supplemental appendix. He had made two remarks to the effect that her obtaining the detail was somehow illegitimate.
Is that a racist comment?
I believe a reasonable jury could infer that it was.
Why? Why is that a racist comment?
Because there was an attitude towards her and other African Americans at the IRS of a lack of confidence.
You're really asking us to, you are using the term begging the question has fallen into way too broad a use for things it doesn't mean, but you are begging the question. We're asking how do we know there was a hostile racial atmosphere? You say, well, certain remarks were made. We say, how do you know those were racial remarks? You say, because there was a hostile racial atmosphere. You're completely in a circle. What's the independent evidence of any kind of hostile racial atmosphere after she came back from the White House within 45 days of the council?
The comments that we have are the comments that her obtaining the detail was illegitimate and that her
evaluation... But how is that racist?
Maybe sexist, right? No question it would be perhaps part of a hostile work environment claim if there was allegations of sexual discrimination. But how is it racist?
I think that it could be construed... If it can be construed as sexist, I believe it could also be construed as racist.
Why?
Well, there's no comment in it saying she's a woman and therefore she couldn't get it. But if we could infer that that was a sexist comment, we could also infer that it's a racist comment.
No, but the comment was special relationship, and I thought perhaps that's the thought Judge Griffith's comment suggested.
The other, essentially what it boils down to is that she couldn't get ahead in her career because of the poor opinion they had of her, that she couldn't get ahead without some sort of illicit act, which we feel is part of the earlier overt claims of racism that had caused her medical difficulties as documented by the doctor's note. The second, moving on to the discrimination claim, the district court erred by holding that the IRS's designation of Ms. Greer as absent without leave was not an adverse employment action in that it did not cause her objectively tangible harm. However, the designation caused her harm in two ways. First, it denied her pay at a time when she should have been given leave, or preferably, she should have been given a hospitable environment in which to work. And second, being designated AWOL was the primary justification for her firing. The third error is that the district court held that the IRS's justification for designating her as AWOL and terminating her was not a pretext for discrimination. Now, the district court did find that she had established a prima facie case of discrimination and that the IRS had articulated a facially legitimate basis for its actions. But she can challenge that explanation in three ways: through her prima facie case, through direct challenges to the legitimacy of that explanation, and through independent evidence of discriminatory statements or attitudes of the employer. Now, first, on the prima facie case, it included allegations that white employees were treated differently when they requested leave and office reassignments. Second, the IRS's explanation for designating her as AWOL is that she was absent from work without a doctor's excuse. But she had a doctor's excuse, and in fact, the doctor said that the environment was causing her medical condition. He said that she was cleared to return, but that she should be removed from the environment. And a reasonable jury could find that she was not unconditionally cleared to return to work, and that the IRS's insistence to the contrary was, in fact, a pretext for discrimination. The other thing she was fired for was wrongful acceptance of jury pay, grand jury pay. But she didn't accept the payment. She emphatically rejected it. As soon as she found out she was being overpaid by direct deposit into her bank account, She asked the IRS to stop. She asked them to quantify the overpayment so she could return it immediately. But nevertheless, they continued overpaying her despite her protests, and then they fired her, claiming that she had wrongfully accepted those payments. And then the IRS would not even tell her after 6 to 8 months how much she had been overpaid. She tried to give all the money back. And a reasonable jury could find that the IRS was doing nothing more than building a paper trail to fire her. And the third point is that her independent evidence of discriminatory attitudes are all throughout the complaint and her deposition and the record. And that evidence includes racially hostile statements made by management and by others with management's knowledge. Mr. Owens, the official who signed the termination letter, he was the one that had derisively nicknamed her Mrs. Martin Luther King, had called her uppity in response to her activism at the IRS. And then he signed the termination letter while an EEO complaint was pending against him. We feel that that violates IRS requirements that the deciding official in a personnel action be impartial. And based on this information, a reasonable jury could find that the reasons for her firing were a pretext for discrimination, and it was error to grant summary judgment. If there are no questions, I'll reserve my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Hear from the government.
Good morning. My name is Andrea McBarnett, and I represent the Internal Revenue Service. We ask that the court affirm the district court's findings. The district court found several things here. First, the district court found that the plaintiff failed to exhaust her hostile work environment claims as well as her termination claim. The district court also found that for part of the hostile work environment claim, it found on the merits in favor of the defendants. And I guess beginning with the hostile work environment claim, the plaintiff simply did not exhaust any racial comment, alleged racial comment, within 45 days of having heard those comments or incidents. And that's fairly straightforward and simple. The one remark that the plaintiff claims she exhausted wasn't race-based. She seems to suggest that her supervisor made an innuendo that she had some sort of affair in order to get her detail. That remark, if it occurred, and it's based on impermissible hearsay, she didn't hear that herself. She heard it secondhand, perhaps even thirdhand. That comment, if anything, we could argue is sex-based or sexually hostile work environment, not race-based. For that reason, we believe the court should affirm the district court's finding of failure to exhaust. As for her term, if the court doesn't have any questions, I'll go on to the termination claim. For the termination claim, the plaintiff also failed to exhaust. She had 45 days after her termination to go to an EEO counselor, and there is no evidence in the EEO counseling report that she did indeed talk to an EEO counselor. The plaintiff suggests that she spoke to someone, but she has no evidence of that. And a mere allegation at the summary judgment level is not enough to overcome summary judgment. So again, we ask that the court affirm the district court's finding of failure to exhaust on the termination claim. Then finally, the plaintiff claims that being designated AWOL was somehow racially discriminatory.
I take it from the briefing that you now, by your silence, concede that Burlington Northern establishes that the AWOL designation was, in fact, an adverse employment decision?
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor. No, the government does not do that. In fact, the district court found that the AWOL designation didn't even pass a prima facie case. Here, AWOL...
She was put on leave without pay or benefits.
She was out of the office without leave.
Without
and
pay or benefits.
Certainly without pay.
That's not adverse.
It's not adverse because the plaintiff was literally out of the office without leave.
That's a different question.
Yeah,
that may establish that the adverse action was justified, but it doesn't address the question of whether or not it's an adverse action.
I don't believe it is an adverse action.
Hasn't our circuit made it clear a change in pay or benefits is adverse? I don't know why the government's pressing this.
I would argue that there has been no change in pay or benefits because her right to pay and benefits is coming to work. She didn't come to work, so there's no action that...
Once again, that's a different question.
I beg your pardon?
That's a different question. If to say that she... It's okay to cut her pay. That's a defensible argument. She didn't come to work. She doesn't get paid. That makes sense. But to say that not paying her is not an adverse action is not the same question at all. And what's troubling us, or at least two of us, is we don't see why it's not an adverse action. Now, you don't have to win on that issue. Mm-hmm. But you may be picking the wrong ditch to die in if you're trying to defend her.
I don't mean to be hard-headed, Your Honor. I'm not sure if I am grasping your point.
Why isn't it an adverse action to stop somebody's pay? Don't tell me why they're stopping. Just start with the proposition that somebody's pay is stopped. Why is that not an adverse action?
It's not an adverse action because pay is contingent upon performance.
I didn't say it. I said ignore the reason for stopping the pay. Ignore the reason for stopping the pay. Just look at the action of stopping the pay. Why isn't that adverse?
Because I can't get around the fact that pay just doesn't come.
You can't get around the fact that it's adverse, counsel.
Well.
They may have had a good reason to take the adverse. There's nothing unlawful about taking an adverse action. It's taking the adverse action for unlawful reasons that you want to avoid.
Okay.
Adverse actions are taken all the time. And I don't see how the government can expect us to hold that it's not adverse, especially given the precedence Judge Rogers referred to stop somebody's pay and benefits.
It would have to shift from certainly getting paid. At a certain point, Ms. Greer was on leave, there's AWOL and there's leave without pay. Leave without pay, you don't get paid. So the shift to AWOL, mm-hmm. It's not adverse. There's no payment either way. So... Yes, the government feels that there was no adverse action.
Are there benefits when you're on leave without pay?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm not quite sure. I'd have to double-check with agency counsel about that, but I'm not 100% sure if benefits are cut off with leave without pay or with AWOL.
Okay. They are on AWOL, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure.
And it depends what the statement is. I mean, you can be put on leave, and you can be put on leave without pay, and you can be put on leave without pay and benefits, but her evidence is she didn't get pay or benefits. And the district court's ruling just doesn't deal with our precedent, much less, as Judge Griffith points out, a more recent Supreme Court decision. Move beyond that.
Okay, moving beyond whether it's an adverse action, her claims don't make even a prima facie case because Title VII doesn't give district courts authority to become a personnel department to examine each and every action of a business entity, certainly as minutely as denial of leave. And there's court precedence for that in, I believe it's Barber versus Browner. And then another issue here is that Ms. Greer can't deny that she was actually given all the money that she was owed for annual leave. So again, ultimately, there was no harm, even if you believe her argument that she didn't get her payment.
That's Burlington Northern. You've got to overcome that.
Your Honor.
Making good later on doesn't necessarily show that there hasn't been adversity here.
That's true, Your Honor. If we can get past the fact that she doesn't have a prima facie case, and we shift the burden to the defendant to explain their actions, certainly with AWOL, as the district court found, no reasonable juror would find that the plaintiff should not have been designated AWOL. She was out of the office without leave.
Why didn't the district court look at whether there was a racial animus behind that designation?
Yeah. In fact,
the person who made the decision was someone who had earlier made one of these offensive comments.
The court did look at the racial animus, and they found that there was no racial animus in this context because the person who made the decision was her new supervisor, not the old supervisor who she found to be, or she claimed to be, discriminatory. Her new supervisor, the plaintiff had never even met.
I thought this was Mr. Carter.
Mr. Carter was the new supervisor. Mr. Owens was the old supervisor.
Right, but I thought there was evidence about Mr. Carter's previous remarks.
Ms. Greer had never met. She claims that he made some remarks regarding her getting a detail. And the remarks that he made on their face don't look as if they have anything to do with race. So, again, those remarks were made outside of her hearing. So she has no firsthand evidence of what even was said or what the implication of what was said at that time. Overall, again, the government doesn't believe that there's a prima facie case for the AWOL claim. And certainly, if we look at the merits of the AWOL claim, it's more than clear that the defendant has the right to put someone on AWOL when they refuse to come back to work after their medical reason
has ended. All right, but you know, we have cases that say where the defendant comes forward and puts on defenses, we proceed to see, say, sorry, where the defendant puts on defenses, or in this case, proffers defenses, we proceed to the third step as to whether or not the plaintiff has rebutted them.
Yes, but in this context, if you look at the facts here, where the plaintiff had not come back to the office.
Right, but my only point is we assume a prima facie case and we move on to the third step. And I think your argument is she has not rebutted the reasonable business reasons for the designation.
Yes, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, the government will rest.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. How much time did you have left?
4 minutes and 32 seconds.
Okay, you got 4 minutes and 32 seconds for rebuttal then, counsel. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I'd like to make a few brief points about Mr. Carter's comments. First of all, we don't believe they were hearsay in that they are acknowledged in Mr. Pollard's affidavit, who heard them firsthand, who is not offering them for the truth of the matter.
Wasn't there, I'm not looking at it immediately, wasn't there a difference in the, what the, it was acknowledged that he had made a remark, but it was not the same remark in the second affidavit, was it?
He was unsure of the exact words used. Mm-hmm. He denies that the words, quote unquote, special relationship were used, but he acknowledges that a statement was made. And then he discusses later on in there how another derisive statement was made. Read in context and read together, a jury could infer that
What's the second statement?
The second statement was that she had her evaluation while on detail was not legitimate.
Thank you.
And that he took, actually Mr. Pollard's affidavit takes great offense, or relates that he took great offense at that comment. And read in context, we believe those could be read as derogatory statements. Again, why those are racial, no, there's nothing racial. There's no words that are there that are sort of that from before the detail, and there's no offensive language. But looking at all the circumstances, the entire pattern.
I guess what makes it difficult here is she's away for 14 months and says she had absolutely no contact.
That's correct.
With the employer. And then the employer reorganizes the office, gives her a new immediate supervisor. And sort of those events, at least the circuits have suggested, they don't bar a hostile environment claim. But it does mean there's some burden on the plaintiff to show that the continuing concern she had in fact remain.
The continuation, I would make 2 points. The continuation is sitting with the people who had made the comments in the past, 14 months
ago. Or one of the people. Now, what is it that you say an agency has to do at this point to keep from having a hostile work environment on the assumption there had been one 15 months before? They're supposed to fire everybody that made remarks she didn't like, or transfer them to a different division? What's supposed to be done?
It depends what those remarks were. But at a minimum, she should be separated from people like that. She has complained in the past.
Well, people like that is a pretty ephemeral statement. I mean, you're saying there was a hostile work environment, so she's supposed to be put in a different environment altogether by getting rid of everybody? All she's saying they did wrong is I was going to be in an office with two other guys, and one of them had made some remarks I didn't like in the past. That's not, she didn't give the atmosphere a chance. She didn't go back at all. We don't know what's happening in the new IRS.
She had been there for 13 years. She gave it 13 years.
No, she'd been gone for 14 months. She had not been there for 13 years. She was there. She was there 13 years. Go back to the verb tenses you might have learned in high school. And this is not a past perfect. This is past. She was there for 13 years. She was gone for 14, 15 months. And we don't know what the atmosphere is at this point.
I would argue that that 13 years that she was there, that the atmosphere continued, had any number of 14-month periods in it.
The point is, you may be right, all right, but you have to offer some evidence to show that. You can't just assume it.
Certainly. The pattern in the past, you have to look at, because it is our claim that it's an entire hostile work environment, you have to look at what is it that made it hostile before, and has it continued, has it been alleviated? In the past, there was a pervasive attitude that black women at the IRS were loose women and that the white women were not, and the comment was a perpetuation of that pattern, Mr. Carter's comment.
Now, what about her would-be new immediate supervisor? What evidence is there as to that person?
The evidence that we have from the deposition, and I don't have the site before me, but there is a statement in Ms. Greer's deposition that Mr. Carter had a reputation of being a racist at the IRS.
That's hardly evidence.
It's sworn testimony in the deposition.
In your brief at 28, you write, as to the final factor, Ms. Greer has proffered evidence that her superiors involved in her AWOL designation and termination, Mr. Owens and Mr. Carter, had made themselves disparaging, racially motivated comments. Mr. Owens was the originator of the Mrs. Martin Luther King label. Now, what role did Mr. Owens play in the AWOL designation? I'm confused. I thought that was Mr. Carter's designation.
Mr. Carter designated her AWOL. Mr. Carter proposed that she be removed based on the two arguments I made before. Mr. Owens signed the letter. Mr. Owens fired her. That's the connection there.
Okay, but I'm focusing specifically on the AWOL designation. What was Mr. Owens' role in the AWOL designation? Did he have any?
I'm not sure that the record reflects that he did.
Well, okay. Your brief is confusing in that regard. Okay. Not helpful.
No further questions, then give us a recess.
Stand, please. This honorable court now stands adjourned until tomorrow morning at 9:30 a.m. Perfect. Thanks.